Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005. It's my pleasure now to introduce David Yulin, who will be putting Rebecca's work in some context and introducing her. David is the author of The Myth of Solid Ground, Earthquakes, Prediction, and the Fault Line Between Reason and Faith. He edited Another City, Writing from Los Angeles, selected by the LA Times Book Review as the best book of a best book of 2001, and Writing Los Angeles, a literary anthology, which received a California Book Award. His essays and criticism appear in many publications, and he teaches in the MFA in Creative Writing program at Antioch University. Like Rebecca Solnit, David is, as Mike Davis says, a hugely original writer. So we'll just see what happens as they talk and make connections and perhaps even get lost together. Please welcome David L. Yulin.
Hi, how are you? I'm just going to start by reading the official Rebecca Solnit biography from the back of this book, and then we'll talk a little bit about what that means, and then I'll bring her out, and she will read. I think Louise just went through all of this, so, and then we'll talk, and we'll ask you to talk, and we'll sign books. So, Rebecca Solnit, it says on the back of this new book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, is a writer whose work focuses on issues of environment, landscape, and place. Her 2003 book, River of Shadows, Edward Muybridge, and the Technological Wild West, won the National Book Critics Circle Award for Criticism and the Mark Linton History Prize. Her other books include Hope in the Dark, Wanderlust, A History of Walking, and As Eve Said to the Serpent on Landscape, Gender, and Art, which was a finalist for the National Book Critics Circle Award in Criticism. In 2003, she received the Lannan Literary Award, and she lives in San Francisco. That's a good list. It's a hallmark of an excellent career. But what it doesn't tell you is that Rebecca Solnit is among the smartest people I know. Someone I call when I'm working on a piece and I want to be jolted out of my own frame of mind. Last fall, for instance, after the presidential election, I was writing a piece about California secession. I was in favor of it. And I called Rebecca to get a kind of historical and sociological overview. She told me about the Republic of Jefferson, which I knew nothing about at the time, which is a small breakaway area along the border of Northern California and Oregon that in the 1920s declared itself independent. There are still Republic of Jefferson signs up there on various roads, sides of roads and so forth. And then she went on to suggest that actually secession or California secession was largely a moot point, culturally speaking anyway, because we were already independent, at least philosophically. As evidence, she cited things as elements as diverse as the conservation movement, which started in California with the Sierra Club in the 1890s, and also bioregionalism, noting that when a place like Mendocino, for instance, outlaws the growing of genetically engineered food, it starts a ripple effect nationwide. There are other applications of this that we can see, things like stem cell research, and the fact that what happens here with that will have national effects, or even the emission control standards that will of necessity become national emissions control standards if only by virtue of how many cars get sold here. In the end, it completely changed my perspective on secession, and I ended up writing a piece that was anti-secession. And I want to say that this is what Rebecca's writing does also. From Wanderlust, which framed the simple act of walking through an expansive cultural perspective, to River of Shadows, which argues that Edward Muybridge's experiments with motion photography not only set the stage for movies, but actually, in some very fundamental way, reframed our very sense of time and space, and in so doing, altered reality itself, since what really is the difference between reality and perception? Solnit's new book, or Rebecca's new book, A Field Guide to Getting Lost, is exactly as its title suggests, a book about going off the map, about terra incognita, and how it can change the way we see ourselves. For her, getting lost is not a crisis, but a matter of necessity, a way of stepping outside the grid and opening ourselves up to the unexpected, to discovery, and more important, risk. Framed in 9 essays, it is both a personal and philosophical. It is both personal and philosophical, contemporary and historical, encompassing everything from captivity narratives to the art of mapping, extended meditations on the color blue, the insurrectionary power of punk rock, which I think we'll probably be talking about a little later, and the notion of collapse, of decay, as a source of artistic foment. It is also an open-ended exploration, a book that asks questions rather than presuming answers, which is also what we're going to try and do here tonight. You know the setup. Louise sort of mentioned it to you. Basically, I'm going to bring Rebecca out in a second, but I just want to say I think this is a really rare treat to hear an incredibly original thinker and writer, one who I assign regularly to my students because she blurs the boundaries and makes us look at the entire notion of reading and thinking in a new way. So without further ado, Rebecca Solnit.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, especially here as David delineates California, although getting here from the west side of town is another story altogether I won't get into. Without further ado, since my book is so self-explanatory in its title, let me read a little. The world is blue at its edges and in its depths. This blue is the light that got lost. Light at the blue end of the spectrum does not travel the whole distance from the sun to us. It disperses among the molecules of air. It scatters in water. Water is colorless. Shallow water appears to be the color of whatever lies underneath it. But deep water is full of this scattered light. The purer the water, the deeper the blue. The sky is blue for the same reason, but the blue at the horizon, the blue of land that seems to be dissolving into the sky, is a deeper, dreamier, melancholy blue, the blue at the farthest reaches of the places where you see for miles, the blue of distance. This light that does not touch us, does not travel the whole distance, the light that gets lost, gives us the beauty of the world, so much of which is in the color blue. For many years, I've been moved by the color blue at the far edge of what can be seen, that color of horizons, of remote mountain ranges, of anything far away. The color of that distance is the color of an emotion, the color of solitude and of desire, the color of there seen from here, the color of where you are not, and the color of where you can never go. For the blue is not in the place those miles away at the horizon, but an atmospheric distance between you and the mountains. Longing, says the poet Robert Haas, because desire is full of endless distances. Blue is the color of longing for the distances you never arrive in, for the blue world. One soft early spring morning, driving a winding mountain road across Mount Tamalpais, the 2,500-foot mountain just north of the Golden Gate Bridge, a bend revealed a sudden vision of San Francisco in shades of blue, a city in a dream. And I was filled with a tremendous yearning to live in that place of blue hills and blue buildings. Though I do live there, I had just left there after breakfast, and the brown coffee and yellow eggs and green traffic lights filled me with no such desire. And besides, I was looking forward then to going hiking on the mountain's west slope. We treat desire as a problem to be solved, address what desire is for, and focus on that something and how to acquire it, rather than on the nature and the sensation of desire, though it is often the distance between us and the object of desire that fills the space in between with the blue of longing. I wonder sometimes whether with a slight adjustment of perspective it could be cherished as a sensation on its own terms, since it is as inherent to the human condition as blue is to distance. If you can look across the distance without wanting to close it up, if you can own your longing in the same way that you own the beauty of that blue that can never be possessed, for suddenly of this longing will, like the blue of distance, only be relocated, not assuaged by acquisition and arrival, just as the mountains cease to be blue when you arrive among them, and the blue instead tints the next beyond. Somewhere in this is the mystery of why tragedies are more beautiful than comedies, and why we take a huge pleasure in the sadness of certain songs and stories. Something is always far away. The mystic Simone Weil wrote to a friend on another continent, Let us love this distance, which is thoroughly woven with friendship, since those who do not love each other are not separated. For Vile, love is the atmosphere that fills and colors the distance between herself and her friend. Even when that friend arrives on the doorstep, something remains impossibly remote. When you step forward to embrace them, your arms are wrapped around mystery, around the unknowable, around that which cannot be possessed. The far seeps in even to the nearest. After all, we hardly know our own depths. I'm sort of still on a surface road there somewhere, and thus all the starts and stops. I'll arrive here presently and flow a little more. So, in the 15th century, European painters began to paint the blue of distance. Earlier artists had not been much concerned with the far away in their art. Sometimes a solid wall of gold backed up the saints and patrons. Sometimes the space curved around, as though the earth were indeed a sphere, but we were on its inside. Painters became more concerned with verisimilitude, with a rendition of the world as it appeared to the human eye. And in those days, when the art of perspective was just arriving, they seized on the blue of distance as another means of giving depth and dimension to their work. Often the band of blue towards the horizon seems exaggerated. It extends too far forward. It is too abrupt a change in color. It is too blue, as though they're exulting in the phenomenon by overdoing it. Below the sky, above the putative subject of the painting, in the spaces before the horizon, they would paint a small blue world. Blue sheep, blue shepherd, blue houses, blue hills, blue road, and blue cart. So I'm going to skip you all the painting descriptions and read just a little bit more. One year of drought, the Great Salt Lake fell so low that much of what was ordinarily sea became land, and I went out walking on it toward Antelope Island, which floated above its reflection, a symmetrical solid object like a precious stone, floating in that blue. Miles and miles of what had not long ago been lake had become a puzzle patchwork of shallow pools and damp and dry sand, shallow lagoons of clear water, long fingers of sand that stretched towards the island and its remote reflection in the deeper blue water beyond. Sometimes the sandbars ended in water, and I had to find another way forward. But I could more or less walk directly towards the island for the miles and hours I was out. I walked across ground that was sometimes ribbed sand, sometimes smooth, that sometimes caved in underfoot as though there were pockets of air underneath, that sometimes squelched so that my footprints were surrounded by paler sand where the water had been pressed away by my weight. With that long line of footprints unfurling behind me, I couldn't get literally lost, but I lost track of time, becoming lost in that other way. That isn't about dislocation, but about the immersion where everything falls away. Sometimes there were small sprays of brown oak leaves on the ground, though there were no trees anywhere within sight, and shore was far away. Sometimes sodden, crumpled clots of feather and bone that had once been birds sat on the strand. How the leaves arrived, how the birds died, was unfathomable, that word meaning depths that cannot be plumbed. Behind me, etched high into the rocks and mountains beyond the Great Salt Lake, was the waterline of Lake Bonneville, which had been so much bigger, so much deeper, long ago in a wetter era on Earth, when redwoods grew in Arizona and Death Valley was likewise a lake. 10,000 years or more have passed since a lake ceased to exist, but its ring all around the landscape insisted that where I walked was once deep underwater, just as the flotsam and soft sand reminded me that not so long ago I could have rowed or swum where I was walking. This was new land, temporary land, that would be drowned in winter, and years might pass before it was walkable again, or centuries. Antelope Island, golden in the harsh light, would get larger and clearer as I walked, but always remain ahead, like a dream or a hope. The water that remained was pale blue, and on that scorching October afternoon, a pale sky met it far away, the distinction between water and air hard to make out. One day a few years ago, my mother took out of her cedar chest the turquoise blouse she bought for me on that trip to Bolivia. Actually, let me start a paragraph earlier. This sort of editing on site gets tricky. When I was 2, we lived in Lima, Peru for a year, and all of us, mother, father, brothers, and I, went up into the Andes once and then sailed across Lake Titicaca from Peru to Bolivia. Lake Titicaca, one of those high-altitude lakes, Tahoe, Como, Constance, Atitlan, like blue eyes staring back at the blue sky. One day a few years ago, my mother took out of her cedar chest the turquoise blouse she bought for me on that trip to Bolivia, a miniature of the native woman's outfits. When she unfolded the little garment and gave it to me, the living memory of wearing the garment collided shockingly with the fact that it was so tiny, with arms less than a foot long, with a tiny bodice for a small cricket cage of a rib cage that was no longer mine. And the shock was that my vivid memory included what it felt like to be inside that brocade shirt, but not the fact that inside it I had been so diminutive, had been something other than my adult self who remembered. The continuity of memory did not measure the abyss between a toddler's body and a woman's. When I recovered the blouse, I lost the memory, for the two were irreconcilable, and I saw it go. Sometimes you hear of murals and miraculously preserved bodies, buried, sealed, protected from light and air for hundreds or thousands of years. Exposed to the day for the first time, they begin to fade, crumble, disappear. Sometimes gaining and losing are more intimately related than we like to think, and some things cannot be moved or owned. Some light does not make it all the way through the atmosphere, but scatters. I put the blouse away in my own trunk and then took it out when I began to think of it again and found that my memory had again turned it into something more familiar, to the velvet blouses Navajo women and girls wear. The Bolivian blouse was beaded and had a zigzag neckline of soft blue piping and two blue bows whose ribbons were pressed into flat creases long ago. But the fabric was a striped brocade, not velvet. It was turquoise, the blue of swimming pools and of semi-precious stones, brighter than the sky. Bolivia, I said to a friend who heard oblivion. When I first began to write, I had been a child for most of my life, and my childhood memories were vivid and potent, the forces that shaped me. Most of them have grown fainter with time, and whenever I write one down, I give it away. It ceases to have the shadowy life of memory and becomes fixed in letters. It ceases to be mine. It loses that mobile unreliability of the live. Just as a blouse ceased to be something I recalled being inside and became the garment worn by that unrecognizable toddler in the snapshot when it was handed to me. A person in her 20s has been a child for most of her life, but as time goes by, that portion that is child has become smaller and smaller, more and more distant, more and more faded, though they say that at the end of life, the beginning returns with renewed vividness, as though you had sailed all the way around the world and were going back into the darkness from which you came. For the elderly, often the nearby and recent become vague, and only the far away in time and space is vivid. It's funny, I keep looking for the right place to end. How am I doing on time? Okay. For children, it's the distance that holds little interest. Gary Paul Nabham writes about taking his children to the Grand Canyon, where he realized how much time adults spend scanning the landscape for picturesque panoramas and scenic overlooks. While the kids were on their hands and knees, engaged with what was immediately before them, we adults traveled by abstraction. He adds that whenever they approached a promontory or overlook, his son and daughter would, quote, abruptly release their hands from mine to scour the ground for bones, pine cones, sparkly sandstone, feathers, or wildflowers. There is no distance in childhood. For a baby, a mother in the other room is gone forever. For a child, the time until a birthday is endless. Whatever is absent is impossible, irretrievable, unreachable. Their mental landscape is like that of medieval paintings, a foreground full of vivid things and then a wall. The blue of distance comes with time, with the discovery of melancholy, of loss, the texture of longing, of the complexity of the terrain we traverse, and with the years of travel. If sorrow and beauty are all tied up together, then perhaps maturity brings with it not what Nabham calls abstraction, but an aesthetic sense that partially redeems the losses time brings and finds beauty in the far away. Antelope Island grew closer and closer, larger and clearer, but finally there was a point at which there was no going on. Or perhaps there was, but it would have been meant swimming in that sea that even in its usual state is far saltier than the ocean, and in this drought must have been intensely brinish. I can imagine another version of that journey, in which I stripped and swam, burning my back and bobbing like a cork, to the island, but I do not know what I would have done upon arrival. And I'm not sure that the island was meant to be arrived at, for up close its glowing gold would have dissolved into scrub and soil. I walked back, the island behind me and before me the ruinous salt palace where the truck awaited, back into the world of ordinary clutter. But near where I had started, there was one more surprise in that landscape, a series of shallow indentations where water had dried into salt crystals. One was a carpet of roses, one a heap of straws, one a field of snowflakes, all made of muddy salt, though when I tried to cut away a small cluster of the pale brown roses to take with me, they immediately became less beautiful. Some things we have only as long as they remain lost. Some things are not lost only so long as they remain distant. Thank you.
Well, that must have cheered them up.
Is this on? Yeah, okay. There's a lot to sort of jump in off just of what you read, and I'm going to start with the closing line, which is that sometimes we have things only as long as they remain lost. I'm paraphrasing badly.
Yeah, or verbatim, which could be the same thing. the blouse is, that blue of distance, which is so beautiful and you can never arrive in, and that vision of San Francisco as this city in beautiful misty shades of blue is not a city you can live in. It only exists when it's far away. And I think, that desire to have, to acquire, to arrive doesn't really take into account that it's not going to be blue when you get there and that it's okay to be filled with that desire and to accept the desire in some ways as a constant rather than as a problem to be fixed.
Right, there's a song I keep hearing on the radio that has, I think the lyric is, everything is lovely from far off or something, and I think about that a lot. Everything always seems perfect or desirable in a way when it's far off than when you get close, as you say about San Francisco, your own experience of it. You're in the middle of it, so you can't see that same kind of thing. It reminded very early in the book, you quote this line from the pre-Socratic, I'm quoting you because I'm
Socratic philosopher, or anti-Socratic.
Meno?
Meno? Who knows? I know how to pronounce Muybridge, that's all.
Yeah. The line is, how will you go about finding that thing the nature of which is totally unknown to you? And early, when you first discovered the line, you cited a sort of a kind of call to arms or a kind of way of seeing the world. Then when you go back and trace the source, you realize that it was framed in a Platonic dialogue and Socrates. It was sort of a foil for Socrates.
Yeah. What it really exemplifies, and a lot of what I'm interested in, the student brought it in and said it was from a pre-Socratic philosopher, and I pictured this wonderful book of resonant fragments, like the fragments of Heraclitus, the one you all know is the one about how you can't step in the same river twice, speaking of being lost in mystery. And I just sort of carried it around for years because it seemed like the key question, how do you go about finding that thing, the nature of which is totally unknown to you? For an artist, the next work, for anybody, sort of the next thing that is going to happen to you, what you're going to do with your life is really, totally unknown to you. How do you navigate in a world in which you have to be sort of conscious and make some decisions, but you don't really know what's going to happen? How do you find that balance between leading a life of complete safety, predictability, and familiarity and just completely being shipwrecked? And that's what because I'm not advocating like go into the jungle and be eaten by jaguars. I'm not for like completely mindless bashing around for the sake of lostness. And just as this question is about how will you go about finding that, I'm interested in how do you go about getting lost rather than, hey, being lost is good. And there is a difference, isn't it? But the funny thing about that is when I finally Googled Meno, little did the Socratics and pre-Socratics and did the ancient Greeks know that they would be Googled. I realized that if I'd ever known, I'd forgotten that it's a dialogue, that Meno is a Platonic dialogue, and like all Platonic dialogues, they're also rigged boxing matches. Socrates always wins. Although it's funny, when you read them, it's sort of... Socrates is so disagreeable and so obnoxious that I don't think, you know, he wins for Plato. I'm not sure he wins for the rest of us all the time. And so Meno asks this question, and Socrates tries to trounce him and doesn't really succeed. And then Socrates himself has to fall back on talking about reincarnation and saying, your question is false because, of course, we already know everything. But what he's saying in that we already know everything is that we've been reincarnated endless times, which just says, okay, our souls know everything, but we've been so many different people and we don't know who those people are. So he just relocates the mystery. He doesn't resolve it and he doesn't really defeat Meno. And I liked those stages, you know, the point at which it was a lost fragment from a book that didn't exist, the point at which I found its context, the point at which Socrates has to abandon rational discourse to fall back on reincarnation theory to, you know, speaking, you know, to try and trounce Meno or top him. You know, all those stages fascinated me, and I think it's still a great question.
Well, it's an interesting metaphor almost for what you're doing here, because it's sort of your appreciation of the line shifts the more you learn, but in the end, it still remains an open question. And it seems to me that throughout the book, that's kind of what's going on here. One of the things that really interests me about this book are the captivity narratives, whether they be the, say, Cabezo de Vaca, or whether it be women who were captured in Indian raids and became the phrase is escaping me, basically were brought and replaced dead family members. And how in many cases those things which seemed to be terrible and seemed to be catastrophic became life transforming, and not in a Stockholm syndrome kind of way, but in a much more fundamental way. Those captives adapted the culture of their captors and became much more aligned with the, in some way, by being lost, they were actually found.
And the real shock to the 17th and 18th and 19th century Europeans and Euro-Americans was that so many of them refused to come back into the white world once they had been acculturated, that they thought it was much better, and that was just so unimaginable. And so there was this whole language of being lost and sort of lost to Jesus, lost to your family, but these people weren't lost at all. So there's this funny debate about whether, in what sense are they lost, but also, you know, it was part of that whole blue of distance thing for me too, that those negotiations were always making between the near and the far, because part of what I love about the captivity narratives I looked at is, for all these people, you know, they get lost in Native America in some sense. They're kidnapped, they stray, they're adopted. Some sort of radical transition takes place. And they pine to be back where everything is familiar. And they kind of carry that longing around for a long time. And sometimes very gradually, sometimes suddenly they realize that home is not that sort of blue of distance yearning far away over the horizon. Home is where they are right now. And that to go back, as one of the captivity narrative characters I talk about does, would itself be, you know, would be to be alienated and all over again and worse. There was a case, I can't remember her name off the top of my head, speaking of lost, that a woman who was taken by the Comanches, married one of the chiefs, had two sons, was completely happy with her life, but she was kidnapped back and essentially pined away and died.
With her daughter,
who also died of white disease, and she died, I think, partly because she refused to eat and was so weakened. And her sons, who had been moved to a reservation in Oklahoma, came back and exhumed her and moved her corpse, her remains to the reservation. But she was never happy. You know, she essentially refused to acculturate a third time to become white again. And so that way in which the far had become the near and the near had become the far, they were put back in their original culture and it wasn't theirs anymore. It wasn't home. And, in that magical moment when they flip somehow.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the Cabezo de Vaca story, which I'll ask you to just sort of tell briefly, but that it's almost a reading that story is almost like seeing a kind of winnowing process where he's sort of reduced to his elemental self, where all of these kind of acculturated desires or beliefs or structures are stripped away in the course of this long journey. And so that when he finally does come up against his countrymen again 10 years later, it isn't at all what he was expecting.
Should I recount the Cabeza? Cabeza de Vaca was a part of the Spanish conquistadors exploring Florida. He had this complete idiot leading his expedition. They got hopelessly lost in Florida, and decided to walk to Mexico, not realizing quite how far it was, although they knew they were in for something. Only 4 of them ever returned.
Out of 600.
And, some of them may have led perfectly happy lives among the tribes or in other ways. They didn't all, but a lot of them died of disease, starvation, were killed in conflicts with the people they ran into. And Cabeza de Vaca, as David said, had this amazing ability to just shed things and drop things and keep moving. He kept walking. He was captured. He was a slave. He freed himself. He became a trader. He became a shaman. He became a great healer, and he lost his clothes. He lost his languages. He lost everything. They were out in the sun so much that he and the other white guys, he said, peeled twice a year like snakes. Just such a wonderful image, because they really, it is, this an alchemical image of the shape, the snake shedding its skin. This guy who just keeps, has some sense of purpose and identity, but it's so deep and so elusive that it can survive all these different phases he has. And finally, in the end, he goes through Texas, through New Mexico, down into towards Mexico. He runs into conquistadors who are busy rounding up and enslaving the natives, and which completely horrifies him. And he's become much more like the Native Americans and like the conquistadors. And yet he goes back to Spain, although it takes him years to learn to sleep in a bed and wear clothes and all these things again. And you have a sense that he never really, that something I think that happens a lot with immigrants and refugees now, where he never really fully belongs in either place.
Right.
And it's with him, it's a little bit of a surprise that he even went back. And but he did. But the person who came back was so clearly, even though it's written in this sort of 17th or 16th century language where there's no sort of memoirist, psychological, autobiographical reflectiveness, he's so clearly not who he was when he set out. And that suppleness, that ability to, to be lost and to not be, disaster struck, to not be at a loss in some sense.
Well, I was going to ask about that because it's interesting in his case, or even when you talk about 19th century America and 19th century Americans, one of the things you talk about is a way in which people weren't lost, even if they were lost, that there was more of a survivability. If someone was lost in the woods or confused in the woods, I think as Daniel Boone said,
yeah,
there's a Daniel Boone quote where he says, "I never was lost in the woods in my life, although I was once confused for 3 days." But even if someone was confused in the woods for 3 days, they had survival skills. They knew sort of what plants and animals were that they could eat. They knew how to build shelters and how to navigate. Things that we have completely lost, speaking of being lost.
Speak for yourself, David.
Well, I'm a city dweller,
okay,
born
and
bred.
Well, yes. I was full of figure four traps and how to make fish hooks out of bone kind of knowledge when I was a kid, which is maybe where some of this comes from. That and growing up in the California hills, trying to figure out what they meant and what it would mean to be native here, something I dropped and then took up again 20 years later. But it was interesting for me, because I wrote a wonderful historian, Aaron Sachs, who's doing a book about Humboldt for our editor. And we have the same editor.
We should have disclosed
Paul,
that.
Paul Slovak at Viking. But that's all right, because we'll fight later anyway. And once we figure out what you're wrong about. So I wrote to Aaron about, how did these 19th century explorers avoid getting lost? And he wrote back, of course they were lost the whole time. It just wasn't a problem for them. They'd never been there before. Nobody they knew had ever been there before. There were no maps. They were just very good at and very comfortable with being in circumstances where there was a great deal of unknown. I'm not lost the way Cabeza de Vaca was, because what fascinates me about him is that he was in a world where there weren't even words for alligators and skunks and beavers and things.
He was on a foreign planet, essentially.
And the New World, as it's miscalled, was entirely new for those people. And, by the time of John C. Fremont or somebody like that. And that fascinated me, because I think that, these guys are problematic in some ways as sort of imperial conquistadors in the 19th century, too. Whether it's John Wesley Power, John C. Fremont, or some other John, indigenous land. But that resourcefulness, that ability to be at home in the unknown, in its literal sense, I think, could really be thought about in a more metaphysical way. So you know, do you dare to venture into the unknown? Do you panic when you actually encounter it? And I was raised by people who became extremely anxious or angry when things did not go exactly according to plan, and had this wonderful sort of jock car mechanic boyfriend. Our car broke down in a very remote place once when I was 21, and it was just a revelation to me that it wasn't a problem. You know, of course, partly it wasn't a problem because he had tools in the back seat and he fixed it in 5 minutes. But just the sense like, well, if not plan A, then plan B. If not plan B, then we'll keep improvising. And that kind of relaxed, improvisational way of moving was a huge influence on me. And, you know, and again, I'm using literal examples to talk about metaphysical things. But this is one of the reasons I write about place so much. I think that in the journeys that are our lives, that are our transformations, that are how we go about finding that thing which is totally unknown to us, literal travel in the sort of actual landscape and urban scape constantly serves as a really rich metaphor for me and a way of studying and representing these things that can't, you know, that can't be seen.
Mm-hmm. I mean, this is very much a book about place. We were talking about this before, but it's about place in a really interesting way because a lot of the references are almost deliberately vague. You'll be specific about particular places, like for instance, the Salt and Sea, San Francisco.
Yeah.
But there are a lot of places where you just talk about long drives through the West, or places where you camped, or a part of the desert, or you come upon a desert tortoise, and it's very specific in terms of what the description is and what the scene is, but almost deliberately vague in terms of the actual place names. It's true of people as well. I mean, one of the most striking instances is when you quote the Rumsfeld quote about there are known knowns and unknown knowns.
Yeah.
And,
the one and poetic thing this administration will ever give us.
And you refer to it as, if I can, you know, during the build-up to the recent war in Iraq, whose two great central rivers come as close as anything on earth to the biblical paradise with four rivers flowing out of it, one of the vultures making the case for bombing Baghdad civilians said, there are known knowns, there are things we know, we also know there are known unknowns, that is to say we know there are... I don't need to read the whole quote, but it's clear, it's...
You should. Do you guys still remember? And then there are the unknown unknowns, and then...
The ones we don't know. Right?
And then, yeah... And then I can never pronounce his name. Can you, Slavo?
No, I can't pronounce anything.
Slavo Zizek. We'll just mispronounce his name unless somebody wants to shout it out. What she said, in his wonderful Lacanian psychoanalytic way, said. And then, of course, there are the unknown knowns, the things we don't know we know, which
right.
which is precisely
the Freudian unconscious, the knowledge that doesn't know itself. But I mean, it's an interesting thing. Even in as recognizable a quote as that, you choose to sort of, again, be specific, but also kind of be specifically vague or vaguely specific. And I'm curious about that, both as a strategy in general for the book, and also in terms of the specific issue of place, because as you say, place is very much a part of both being lost, or you get lost in a place, and also in terms of this book in particular, these meditations on being lost.
And it was partly about the whole nature of the book. I had just finished the Muybridge book, which was a huge, colossal pleasure for me, and an intense research project, and I spent several months reading primary materials in archives in Britain and the East Coast and all over California, and, you know, in old newspapers and sifting through photographs and stuff. And that book has 15,000 words of footnotes. And, you know, and it was very precise because I wanted to lay the groundwork for whoever came after me, and I wanted to prove that I didn't make any of it up, unlike some recent historians. And when I was done with it, I was sort of clumping around saying, I'm sick of writing books, I don't want to do another one. And then I realized that I wasn't sick of writing books. I was sick of being under contract and on deadline, which meant essentially that I couldn't get lost and I couldn't fail. I had to know exactly where I was going to end up. And so I wrote this book when nobody was looking, and without a contract, without a deadline, not sure how, you know, really kind of bushwhacking, not sure how it would turn out. And I wanted it to be antithetical to that kind of informative stuff I've done that's useful in those practical senses where you know exactly what day Muybridge murdered his wife's lover or you know or some nugget like that. And so this is my first book with no subtitle, no acknowledgments, no bibliography, no footnotes, no, you know, all the apparatus of and stuff. And with the places, it was partly that I didn't want people to get bogged down in thinking like, oh, maybe we should go there. Oh, I don't like that place. Oh, that's a place for rich people, or that's a place for non-white people, or, you know, to sort of really load it all up with specifics. And sometimes when I'm talking about the Great Salt Lake, there are not two giant salt oceans in the middle of the West.
Right.
And maybe there's one and a half. But, you know, and San Francisco is very definitely San Francisco and very present in the book twice. But a lot of the other places, like it's pretty clear the last chapter takes place a lot in the county just north of the Golden Gate Bridge. That's
the county in which you were raised.
Yes, I like to avoid saying Marin County as much as possible in my personal life as well. I grew up in the sort of the Simi Valley of the North. The town I grew up in is where all the San Francisco cops live, and it's very right wing, or certainly was then. And it's, you know, and also when you say Marin, everybody sees Mill Valley and
houses on stilts and Grace.
And so those were some of the reasons I wanted to keep it vague, is to really get at, you know, the essence of the place rather than that, and to be a little slippery myself, I suppose.
Yeah, no, I mean, it also, to me as a reader, it gives the book a kind of mythological quality where you're talking, I mean, you're stripping away my landmarks. You know, I think it's true. When I read about a place where I've been, I'm always superimposing my own experience on it, whether it's a kind of an emotional reaction or whether it's simply a visual thing where I am less imagining through the writer's eyes than I'm superimposing my own visual memory of that place onto the words, and then it sort of distances me somewhat. But it felt, I mean, there's a kind of dreamy quality, and I don't mean dreamy in a vague sort of ethereal sense, but there's a dreamy quality to that stripping away of those specific place names that kind of draws us more into the emotional life of the essays rather than a kind of specific physical life.
Oh, good. I was wrong about the possibility he'd be wrong. He's right about that, more so than I was.
What
he said.
What I said. And I also think that sometimes it's really interestingly explicit in things like Slip, which is, there's a long passage about Vertigo, about the Alfred Hitchcock movie Vertigo, in this book. And then there's a reference to a kind of, would it be accurate to characterize it as an unwritten book, right? That Rebecca came up with, which is sort of the backstory of Midge, who is Jimmy Stewart's best friend, played by Barbara, I think it's Barbara Bel Geddes, right?
Yeah.
She's with the glasses, and she's very sensible, but then there's a whole other sort of sidelight.
Should I say a little bit about that? Because I loved it. I love the movie Vertigo, even though it's, speaking of Freudianism, horribly fraught. And partly because it takes place in the San Francisco my first book was about, which is also a kind of bohemian counterculture, much more wide open set of possibilities. And Midge, in the first, her first appearance, almost in this, I think the second scene in the movie, is Jimmy Stewart sort of, you know, they were engaged, she broke it off, which is something that the rest of the movie kind of belies, so it makes it seem like she's forlornly in love with him, not that she dumped him and stuff. But she's the one who has the key to San Francisco. She's the one who knows her way around the city and helps him, introduces him to the bookseller, who knows about, you know, the old legends and knows these other things. And she really has this wonderful relationship to the city and this sense, and she draws women's lingerie, particularly, you know, she's drawing a bra for, and that's what she does for a living. She's a visual artist and she draws lingerie. And she has this sort of polymorphous sexuality that's just so much less depressing than Jimmy Stewart's obsession with, not just with Kim Novak, but Kim Novak, but only if she's wearing that gray suit and et cetera. And
the ash blonde hair.
It really felt like, you know, and I just imagined during a crisis, another version, a rewriting that, the way that, you know, the Wicked Witch of the West has finally gotten her due with Wicked, the way that Jean Rice rewrote Wide Sargasso Sea, of something from Midge's point of view. And so, and it was while I was, I think, working on Wanderlust, I had no time to write novels. I had to come up with a feasible second draft. So I had this novel that I wrote a lot of in my head and I knew that it would be so painful to like write one sentence or one chapter and have to set it aside. And so, and as a person deeply committed to nonfiction, that was part of the musing challenges. How do you make a novel that never existed into nonfiction? and recounting it in this sort of memoiristic way of like what it might have been, what I remember of it, and what purposes it served was important. But also what I loved about it, I think with country and Western music, which I have a big chunk of prose about, David was mentioning when we were hiding from you back there, and with film noir and with noir fiction, there's a wonderful sense in which human relations are always going wrong. There's usually a love story, but it's blighted, tragic, betrayed, you know, comes to no good end, ends in death, etc. But there's always a second love affair, which is with the place. And Hitchcock loves San Francisco so much in that movie. And you see that in a lot of noir, both the movies and the books. And you see that so much in a lot of the country and Western I love, where, you know, like, you know, I give the example of Long Black Veil, for those of you who know it, where the characters have no face whatsoever. We know nothing about them except that they're adulterous lovers and he's been dead for 10 years and she, as you know, walks these hills in a long black veil. But, you know, there's the gallows, there's the hills, there's the grave, there's the courtroom, and there's, you know, and even more so in a lot of other songs, there's this deep sense of place in a sense that, you know, these places are all also characters in our lives that we forget to think of. You know, they're also like parents or deities or lovers or friends or something like that, and I really wanted the places to be like that, you know, for the readers the way they are for me. And I think that's one reason to make them not so specific, so that you guys wouldn't be saying, oh, that's not my desert.
Right, right. And yet they decay also. I mean, one of the things that the book talks about is sort of the industrial decay, or the decay of industrial culture in cities in the early 1980s. You talk about sort of your relationship with punk rock and how punk grew out of that, and how that in some sense we all misread it and saw it as sort of the end of something, as an apocalyptic landscape, when really it was just going to be the seedbed for the new artificial intelligence, cyber, depersonalized landscape that we now live in. In some ways, this new landscape is far bleaker than that landscape.
Yeah, I came of age with punk rock, and one of the, you know, and Reagan, you know, punk rock started in 77, but it was really going full swing in 1980 when Reagan got elected, and people really expected a full-fledged nuclear war. And that sort of no future of the Sex Pistols and the no future of nuclear Armageddon were weirdly interfused in that early 80s moment. And ruins were such a key landscape for imagination at that time. So many of the first rock videos on MTV, so many sort of, you know, Deborah Turberville sort of fashion imagery, distressed leather, this whole aesthetic of decay and ruin came in. And people always portrayed the ruins as what we're about to become in Blade Runner, in Terminator, in Mad Max, Road War and stuff. And what nobody really talks about is that the modernist city of the first half of the century had fallen into ruins in San Francisco and New York and everywhere else. And there's some places like Detroit where it's still in ruins, but, you know, because in Detroit, I think many things have been destroyed and abandoned since 1967. Nothing's been built. But that landscape of ruin was actually not only very fulfilling to romantics like me, but kind of wide open in that there's a lot of squatting and performing and photographing, and, you know, and for gay men and the Chelsea Piers, which were all ruins before they became luxury health clubs, cruising, and it was this real free space. And I was fascinated by the way that cities can become a wilderness and that you can explore them in those ways. And that was the period for me that the city really was a wilderness in a really rich and wonderful way. Although I'm looking at George Herms in the front row, for whom cities were a wilderness in the 1950s, when he was scavenging the urban renewal known as Negro removal in San Francisco. But that was a much more intentional creation of ruins, not of abandonment, but of people being forced out. But those ruins fascinate me, and the bleakness, I think, of a lot of modern cities, in some ways San Francisco and New York in particular, but all the sort of bright, shiny cities, is all that breathing space, all that in-between space for people who didn't quite fit in, all that space to be poor, to be weird, you know, to be Puerto Rican drag queens at 3 a.m, etc., has all been kind of turned into maximum real estate, you know, full of IKEA and Starbucks and
Nike Town.
And something was really lost. And it's not that, you know, not that I don't think cities should probably have some kind of economy, although thank God we're not here to talk about economics, but the ruins were really quite wonderful.
And yet, what's interesting, too, about this whole book and this process, partly your sense of the ruins and partly how the book ends with this discussion of sort of the reclamation, of nature, is that there is a sense of reclamation, that in a book or a world that's about being lost, you talk about how human life, we feel that we're supposed to hold on to things, but that things are being lost all the time. There is a way in which things are reclaimed, whether it be animal species repopulating or being or being reintroduced to natural landscapes. And we were talking earlier about your book, Hope in the Dark, and the idea of sort of being comfortable with uncertainty and looking for sorts of, I don't want to be too optimistic, but ways of optimism or ways of being hopeful and positive. And I'm curious if you could comment on that.
Well, optimism is a kind of certainty, too, that everything's going to be fine, whereas I think hope is really kind of a comfort with uncertainty, that we don't know what's going to happen, but maybe what we do is going to play a role in it, so it's still worth doing. But yeah, the last chapter actually changed while I was writing it. I was staying at a writer's residence in West Marin, and far from Mill Valley, and Novato, happily. And, you know, and this amazing ornithologist named Rich was assigned to take us around and orient us, and I was grumpy at first because, like, you know, I spent my whole life there, almost all of it, one way or another. But he showed me this completely different world, because I don't really look at animals. I look at landscapes and plants and the color blue and the distance and things like that. But what was amazing is that as an environmentalist, the story I've always been told is we keep encroaching, things keep disappearing, that it's that simple, that it's always about development, it's always, and that's why things disappear. His story was that until 50 years ago, we shot at everything that moved. I mean, ranchers were shooting eagles and hawks, and everybody was shooting coyotes and mountain lions, and everything that moved was sort of fair game for pot shots. And then 50 years ago, we pretty abruptly stopped. And it's true, the county that I grew up in had no coyotes, had no mountain lions, and a lot of species, you know, the elephant seals, which almost became extinct in 1900 when, like, whales, they were being mined for their blubber, you know, have made a comeback, and about 15 years ago came back to that county where they'd been historically. The tule elk that almost became completely extinct in the 1870s have rebounded so much, they don't quite know what to do with them anymore. And, you know, and it was this weird story because a lot of species have come back, and a lot of environmentalists are afraid to do that because then people will say, well, then everything's fine, we don't need to do anything, and everything is not fine. And, you know, my hopefulness is not that we don't need to do anything. My hopefulness is only that sometimes when we do things, it actually makes a difference some of the time, you know, with no results guaranteed. But so there was that redemption of these things that were lost and came back, which is also, I think, about, you know, you could configure another way, and I don't want to get too into wordplay with loss, but the theories about the direction of the universe turned out to be going in the wrong direction too, because not every, in some sense, that this sort of analysis that every, you know, the kind, what I think of these days when I think about the left is the voice of Eeyore, we are all doomed, it is all getting worse, everything is disappearing, you know, is also not, you know, is also not useful enough, but also,
it's not useful in any real way. I mean, it's, you know, it gets to the point where you just, at least I just delete all those emails from my email queue without ever reading them. Because
shocking newsflash, Bush is Satan.
Well, yeah. Shocking newsflash, Bush picks a conservative, you know, for the court. What did we expect that he was going to pick?
I know, really? that's the part of the left. It's kind of like, what did you, you know, that tragic disappointment of insane optimism.
Now that's an essay, I think.
It actually went out on Tom Dispatch last week. It's called The Great Gray Whale, or This Story Has No Moral. Because I was fascinated by the extraordinarily grumpy response to the G8 summit, whose two, you know, of course, its unofficial platforms were probably finding exciting new ways to screw everyone on the earth, well, except for corporations. But its official platform, she said cheerfully and hopefully. And, well, okay, I'm hopeful and stupid are different categories, but I like to think. But the things that Tony Blair did as his bait and switch on the war was to obsess about African poverty and its relationship to African debt and about climate change. And Bush, you know, what a surprise, stymied any real work on climate change. But the financial ministers meeting before the G8 succeeded under immense pressure, thanks to decades of work by activists, in canceling the debt of the 18 poorest nations in the world, a $40 billion complete and absolute cancellation of debt. And so many leftists were just grumbling about why that wasn't great. And it was great. And, you know, there are all these conditionalities attached, which are so that the nations will continue to get milked to death by the corporations and et cetera. But, you know, like, what a surprise. And the cancellation not only is a very specific relief. And Zambia said that 100,000 more people are going to have retroviral drugs for AIDS in that country because of debt cancellation. You know, for those 100,000 people, that's not bad.
No, that's a concrete
and,
thing.
Yeah, and, you know, and it was funny because people expected, you know, what they wanted, and I want it too. I want Bush to get down on his knees and admit that he's wrong about everything and capitalism and violence and war and he are extremely bad things and that everything should be different from now on. But I didn't really expect it, so I wasn't really disappointed. Which is why I thought that the cancellation of $40 billion of debt for the 18 poorest nations was actually a good thing.
Yeah, no.
And I was really trying to talk about people coming up. I'm very interested in the gray areas these days, and in this book and Hope in the Dark and this thing I just did on Tom Dispatch, because because it's not black and white. You know, it wasn't everything we asked for. That, you know, it didn't make them into good people. I'm not waiting for politicians to become good people. And, you know, and just teaching people to not look for these sort of Sunday school sports stories, kind of like the Niners won,
right,
or it was three home runs, and, you know, to learn to navigate. And here we get back to this book, learn to navigate these more tricky, shady, ambiguous things that are what we really get given rather than Bush on his knees repenting the way that I wanted.
Right. Right, everything is more than you take it for. So I think we should open it to, for a few minutes at least, to some questions from the floor. So Toby's walking around with a microphone over there. If anyone has a question, raise your hand. She'll give you the mic. We'll call on you. And
hi, thank you for being here. You mentioned Tom Dispatch. Is that a website or an email list?
We call it sort of an electronic wire service. I guess wire services were always electronic in that telegraphic 19th century way. But he publishes a lot. He writes a lot himself. He's a very renowned book editor who started a little blog after 9/11 that went public with the Nation Institute. And then a lot of other people started writing for him. And Chalmers Johnson, Mike Davis, Jonathan Schell, once or twice Noam Chomsky, Susan Sontag. It's where my Hope in the Dark book got developed. He's become, I just sort of like sent it to him out of the blue, and it would turn into a project and then into a book and then into a friendship and into a regular outlet for me. It's, you know, and it's been quite wonderful as because it's officially not a website. All the other progressive websites pick it up, so we can get 100,000 to 150,000 people reading these kind of long, complex, often literary essays by all these writers in a way that you don't get to otherwise. So that's Tom Dispatch. My little plug, .com. Read it today. And I don't even get paid for it. No, wait. This year he started giving us $75 a pop. That's not true.
I don't see lost as necessarily a negative, because I get lost a lot and in driving. And I find things, new things. You use the word optimistic. I never panic. I always know somehow I'm going to get to a filling station or something. And most people, I think being lost is you have to find your way back right away. And I don't feel that way. I like going off the road when I'm driving and going into new things. I think lost is good. And it means new things and found things.
Yeah, there's a wonderful story I was told that I put in this book about a Hawaiian wildlife biologist who gets lost in the rainforest in order to find new species. Only when he doesn't know where he is does he start to see things he's never seen before. And I think that, you know, in metaphorical and literal ways, that going beyond what you know is really important. And, you know, and so I'm in favor of it, you know, and doing it in some way that you don't starve to death in the wilderness or, you know, whatever. But I feel like the whole thrust of the culture is about control, about safety, about certainty, about
you know, there's been so much fear-mongering about don't go there, those people are scary, don't talk to strangers. And I remember when cell phones first started appearing, before I got one and became slightly less grumpy about them. And some friends of I said, why do you need a cell phone, to some friends of mine? And they said, well, like, if we're going someplace, we can call for directions. And it's like, well, you know, you could ask people around. You know, it's just, it was part of, there's constantly this language of, oh, we need to do our banking in the internet. We need to, and, you know, and it very much serves the profit margin for a lot of corporations. If we no longer do face-to-face things, it doesn't, and wandering, getting lost and doing things for free doesn't particularly profit anybody. And I think that you know, there's a real lack of attention paid to what my friend Chip Ward calls he talks about the tyranny of the quantifiable, and that all the stuff that isn't quantifiable, what happens if you don't get there directly? What happens if you walk instead of drive when it takes you a much longer time? What happens if you, you know, actually do go stand in line at the bank, but then you go talk to, you know, the person next to you or see, you know, and just making all that room for these openings where surprises slip in, rather than just thinking, oh my God, must roll up the windows and floor it now, kind of mentality. And so, okay, I'm getting really incoherent. Let's have another question.
Well, this may be kind of so obvious already, but I was just thinking about the element of time in this and how, in a sense, I mean, I can enjoy being lost, but it's a luxury. And I think part of so much of the anxiety about not being able to get lost is, you know, I have to be at my job, or it'd be nice to take a circuitous route and, you know, see what's up that street, but then I might not. So, I mean, those kind of responsibilities and the desire to slip out of them, I mean, I kind of can see why Gauguin, you know, wanted to go to, you know, to Tahiti.
Yeah, no, sometimes I think that the greatest achievement of Reaganomics was not any overt and specific policy, but the creation of an economy in which everybody has to work so damn hard just to stay afloat, with the homeless as a, sort of a living poster for what happens if you don't stay afloat now that there's no safety net, that all that time to wander, to get lost, to muse, to do all these cultural things, to raise kids instead of having everybody have to work 90 hours a week. Kids being a great way to get lost, since they're, you know, the greatest interrupters of any continuity on the face of the earth, and expectation and plan. So I think that there has been a real loss of time to do that. Of course, I don't think doing it on the way to work is necessarily the best possible scenario. But then there is that question with kids, too, I wrote about how kids are so scheduled and controlled and structured, partly because people are afraid of what will happen to them if they wander around, that they never have that experience of wandering that I think develops, and exploring and navigating, that develops resourcefulness and imagination and independence. And it's funny because in some ways I've written four books in a row about the uses of slowness. Ein Wanderlust was about walking, not about driving or flying. The River of Shadows, the Muybridge book, is really about the speed up of everything. And Muybridge invents the new photo technology that's 100 times as fast as anything before to photograph horses in motion for the railroad baron who's built this railroad that's transformed really the shape of the world by making it possible to cross North America in a week instead of in 6 or 7 dangerous surprise-filled weeks, or go through the Panama, go overland, you know, sail down to Panama and go overland or around Tierra del Fuego. And then Hope in the Dark was really kind of partly against all that sort of instant results guaranteed or your money back disappointment that a lot of activists had. We had an anti-war movement in February. We had a war in March. It didn't work, rather than, well... You know, let's look at the more long term, how these things work in more long term and complex ways. And then this book also, you know, is like all scenic detour and no superhighway as a narrative. And but of course, even books are about choosing to go the slow way rather than just, you know, soak up some more car chases
and to get lost.
Yeah.
The American humorist Patrick F. McManus wrote a book where he quoted, "Getting lost requires planning." Did you find that it required a lot of planning to go off and get lost in in some of your writings?
Yes and no. You know, this is a funny book in that it's got a lot of stuff. I actually rewrote a few older things that sort of came up in a new light with this title and collected things and stuff. But mostly I've just planned my life around having some time to do that, although not as much as I'd like the last few years, which is why I don't have any. I have another book coming out next month, but I have no books coming out after that for a while. But, yeah, you know, and I think that almost goes back to your question. I've organized my life to have a little bit more time, as I think when I actually decide to let somebody merge in traffic, and to do these other things, and you know, and to do these things other way. It's funny. The other book is a book about Yosemite Project with some photographers, which is much better than it sounds, and re-photographing Muybridge and some of the other people in the landscape and looking at its changes. And part of why it was so fun is that my collaborator, Mark Klett, has the world's greatest outdoor kitchen, and so we ate really well during our 3 years of expeditions. And it's funny, after the 3 years were up, I suddenly realized that not everybody who goes camping cooks everything from scratch. I think I was in REI seeing the freeze-dried beef stroganoff or something. And it was really funny because it had never even occurred to me that, like, you know, like, if you're going camping, you should make risotto with a headlamp from scratch. You know, I like that slowness. I like that that room. And I think, you know, people are trying to scrape together a living and raise kids. I understand why they're frantic, but I'm not sure that everybody needs to be as frantic as they are.
Time for one more? Okay, this will be the last question.
I wonder, to what extent do you think that this fear of getting lost and obsession with control is a specifically American phenomenon?
You know, you can think about the slow food movement in Europe and things like that, but also, you know, that, and I was just in the UK, and it's sort of normal for people to live in public and to encounter strangers and to move around a little bit more freely with a little bit more trust. And I think we're not just talking American landscape, but particularly a Western landscape of gated communities and never roll down your windows and don't talk to strangers. And, you know, coming from right next door to Silicon Valley, the idea, like, during the dot-com boom, there was this constant praise of the idea that you might never have to see another human being again because even your groceries could come through the internet. Although you might have, actually, you'd have to open your door for the delivery boy, but you could be rude and make it really quick, as many of them did. And, you know, so I think that it is, and I think that the cult of efficiency and convenience is particularly American, and it certainly has you know, chapters in Japan and other places, but I don't think anywhere in the rest of the world is as weird about it as we are. And, you know, it may be out of a particular Americanness that I feel the need to rail against it in different ways than I would in Latin America or, you know, or Italy or something like that, where everything is done differently. I actually realized that in all those places that have siestas or where you eat dinner at home, you can't have suburbia because you can't live very far from where you work, that the world gets designed really differently if people insist on that kind of time. And just the sort of cascading failure of one thing after another, of long commute times and the separation of home and work and all other kinds of segregation. So I think that practically anywhere else in the world serves as an example in some ways. And it's one of the things that, you know, that I like going to Latin America and seeing people, for example, and seeing people who are less obsessed with efficiency and, you know, and the most up-to-date, high-tech, high-speed way of doing everything. And so that's not a particularly resounding note to end on. But David, you saved the day.
Thank you very much.
What he said.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujaki Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolfe. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM and KUSC 91.5 FM. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. Aloud theme composed by Larry Karish.